Eno, and he's the most subtle person anyway, very quiet and very gentle. You hardly know he's there, and yet he's right up there all the time. And he just kept everything psh, 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 going like that. And in the Zendo, Donna Lynn was the Tanto, and so she kept everything in the Zendo sort of going along. She gave two talks, two Dharma talks of the five of them. Very proud of her. Did good. And we had two ceremonies. Robin from Arcata did Jukai on Thursday. And they took a lot of pictures of it that you can see on Facebook. And in the pictures are these little round sort of ethereal looking circles all around her, the atmosphere that John says are angels.
Clarify that a little bit. What does that mean? When a great master like Jesus wants to teach and help his students, for example, he just sends some of his angels. They're really him. They're a part of him. He's divided his, forgive me using the word, he's divided his soul into many, many parts.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's gotten to a place where he can do that.
Yeah.
He makes him stronger and stronger and stronger. And remember Jesus, some quote, I could bring up 20,000 legions of angels.
Yes.
I was referring to that.
I see.
And they send it. It's easier for them to have these angels. And they're always around watching. And in fact, one guy, another student of a guru I met, was saying, he could see them. And there were two of them were hovering around in his room. And the guy was sort of in a bad mood, feeling he's being neglected. You go tell Swami Kaleshwar. And then they took off. But that way, it's a part of them. It is a part of them. It's as if they're there. But they just, it's easier to just send them apart. They see everything. So really what you had was important for the Buddha and probably the other, you know, great Buddhist saints to be there. And they were there. That's how they were there. That's why the great souls are never far away. If you call them, if you bring them to you, they're there in that way.
Well, in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha calls the Buddhas, and Buddhas come from many different worlds and gather around hundreds of thousands of Buddhas. So it's the same metaphor for some kind of something. Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. And then we had an ordination on Sunday for our Jane that was just really amazing. It was a kind of girly thing. It was all the girls took her in after laughing a lot in the Doksan room. Ritu and Samya and Donna Lynn and Jane and I made a little parade, and with the bell and the clappers, ding, clap, and walked Jane in. And she was so direct, so clear. Usually people say, you know, return to Buddha, return to Buddha, return to Dharma. She was just bam like that all the way through the precepts. It was wonderful. There was no question in her mind what she was doing. She just did it. And was lovely doing it. I told them, I feel like a dandelion that's been blown on, that's going to seed all over. Four priests, Donna Lynn and Rose, who was there, and Jane Jasper. So there are four of us who are ordained. And can I say, Ritu is going to start sewing. So it's a very fertile time, you could say, very wonderful time. And there were a lot of people. It was a big crowd. And the little bitty cook just cooked like a demon and made the most interesting food. It was really amazing. She lived in China for 10 years, she told me, so she has a lot of Chinese background. And she brought some of the things we ate, I didn't know what they were. I had no idea. But they were all good.
That explains the lotus bowl, which is one of my favorite things.
In the spaghetti sauce?
It's on the stir fry.
Yeah.
Like citrus, and it has
little holes in it.
Really common.
Yes. Yeah, she was incredible. Well, we have a couple of new faces here. Let's do an introduction around.
I'm Ron.
Wendy. Ritu. Alan. Samuel.
Elijah.
Sam.
John.
Sally.
There you go.
Britt.
Claire. Angie. So now we have the fifth piece of this poem. Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Which is at the top of the back page in your copy. Oh, thank you, Ellie. Yes, sure, whoever doesn't have it. So this part says, naturally real, yet inconceivable. It is not within the province of delusion or enlightenment. With causal conditions, time and season, quiescently it shines bright. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. A hair's breadth's deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. Once basic approaches are distinguished, then there are guiding rules. But even though the basis is reached, and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows. So the poem, after talking about the hexagram and the five ranks, the different stages of meditation in a kind of pseudo-scientific way, I would say, has returned to talking about the mirror itself, the mirror of our sitting, the mirror of samadhi, of being completely present and in the present as it is. Which the poem is saying, it's completely natural. It's not something that we have to cook up ourselves and create it. That if we just sit and wait, actually a lot of what we do is just waiting. If we try to organize it and orchestrate it, we just get all mixed up. So the best way is to sit and let it be what it wants to be. It's natural. It's in us naturally. It is what the world is for us. So when things come right, and we don't know how the causal conditions and the time and the season work together, the causes and conditions are so vast. When we talk about karma, karma is about the causes and conditions of each moment. There are 100 jillion million effects that are all coming together into this one moment here, right now, that brought us all here, right now, that we can't possibly even know what they are. And yet, if we offer ourselves to this practice, to this jewel mirror practice, naturally, it shines. All it takes is sitting down. You don't have to be smart, you don't have to be educated, or tall or short, or girl or boy, or any of those things. Anybody can do it anywhere, at any time. It's one of those rare human ideas that includes everyone. It's understanding our true nature. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. If it's anywhere, it is anywhere. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. There is this that we can't say and we can't put our finger on. It's beyond, and yet it's right here now. Thinking of those little round things in the photograph, my friend Tinley, the Tibetan gal that I had such a good time with when she lived in San Francisco, tells the story of when she was a girl, about 16, a very enthusiastic and busy girl, and she rushed into her teacher's little room to tell him something, and she was just full of excitement, and she ran into his room and slammed the door, and he looked up and he said, "Tinley," he said, "there are beings all around here. You can't see them, but you must be careful and not be so noisy and so to scare everything." She said, oh, I didn't realize. And ever since, she realized that even though we don't see what, there are many things happening that we aren't aware of, that we need to be careful about and to respect. So when you see a Tibetan lama, the way he handles things and does things, it's about seeing how everything is working in that way. So he goes on, "A hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. We talk about attunement or I talk about attunement in talking about Zazen practice. We talk about alignment, and it always feels to me like alignment and attunement are trying to say the same thing. Physically, we try to align our bodies, especially our spine, and align our head with our shoulders and create as much of a free, open body as possible. But with the alignment is an attunement that we begin to feel as we sit with everything. We are actually breathing with everything, with the trees and the grass, the sun and the stars. Everything breathes, and we with it. So as we sit, we begin to feel more and more a part of everything. So when we would come out of the zendo into the rain or the snow and see snow on the cherry blossoms, it's not like it was a scene in a movie. It was like it was us. Deshi Maru said, we must harmonize the cosmos. We ourselves are the cosmos. The intellect is too heavy for understanding. So we can think our way around a lot of things, and very usefully, but to actually attune ourselves and our life, to harmonize our life, means that we sit and allow it to take its proper shape and form. It's a funny thing to say. It always feels like we should do something. But mostly it's just bringing ourselves to be willing to do it. And then, as much as we can, give up and let it do us. Dogen, in Fukan Sazengi, his instructions for Zazen, his first two paragraphs are like this. It sounds so much like this precious mirror. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? How can our practice create the perfect way? It's already perfect. The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one, right? Where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? And yet, if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion, etc. So, a hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. And you experience it with long sitting. You can begin to feel, your whole body-mind system begins to feel more in tune. And then maybe you get a little ambitious and want more, or something happens and you get distracted. They've done interesting studies measuring the mind of Zazen, and in one of them they can measure beginners who, when they hear a loud noise, will be distracted and stay distracted for a long time. And old sitters who've been sitting for a long time, when they hear a noise, also are distracted and immediately come back and continue to sit. And they measure that with their brain waves. So we actually learn how to stay. My friend Mary says it's a muscle. We keep bringing our mind back over and over again until it gets strong, and we don't tend to drift off because of every bird call or sneeze. It is a practice. It doesn't just come. Now, he says, there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. They're talking about sudden enlightenment or gradual enlightenment. And back in this day, there was a kind of light-hearted, basically, competition between the schools of sudden enlightenment and of gradual enlightenment. And the debate was based on the debate that happened in Hongzhen's temple when Hui Neng was there, the woodcutter who heard the Diamond Sutra, a little bit of the Diamond Sutra, and was so struck by it that he hiked 1,000 miles to find the master who taught it. And there was a contest in that temple where Hui Neng was just in the basement pounding rice. That they just gave him a no job at all and didn't even try to teach him. And there was a contest in which the students were all supposed to write a poem to show their enlightened mind. And they all knew that the head student would win, so they let him write the poem that went like this. Our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind is a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight. So we work hard, we keep cleaning ourselves up, purifying, returning over and over. And so everybody thought, that's fabulous. He's obviously going to be the head guy now. And somebody told it to Hui Neng down in the basement, and he said, oh, that's interesting. I could write a poem about that too. And so somebody came with him and wrote for him because he didn't know how. And this is his poem. There is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is void, where can the dust alight? So Shen Shui, the head practicer, was talking about gradual enlightenment, gradual practice, year after year, getting better and better. And Hui Neng was talking about sudden enlightenment, where, as Dogen would say, we're already enlightened. And so our practice is to confirm and cultivate and enjoy our enlightenment. But as I say, they really were expressing just two sides of the same thing. They're both true. We do work hard at it and develop that muscle. And at the same time, we're already there. So in the Sandokaya, it says, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. Don't worry about gradual or instant enlightenment. I'd said before, somebody asked Suzuki Roshi about his enlightenment. Was it sudden or gradual? And he said, oh, it was sudden, but it took a long time. So he's saying here, once basic approaches are distinguished, once we figure out what kind of practice we're going to do, then there are rules. We just go according to how it's set up, which is so nice. One of the nicest things about Sesshin is that once the pattern is set, it takes about a day for everybody to know what to do, then you don't have to think about what to do anymore. If it's a certain time, then it's time to sit. If a bell rings, that means you get up. If it's time to go outside, it's time to sweep the deck or eat a meal. You don't have to figure out what to do with your day. It's already set. And so your mind is free, much more free than usual. Even though it sounds very rigid and strict, it's really the opposite. It's true freedom. But even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows. There's still, it's not big enough. It's still a little confined. And then it goes on to talk about different metaphors for that confinement, which I want to talk about next week. They're just all different ways of how our mind works. It's anxious, it's calm outside and anxious inside often. So here's a story. Kishizawa Ien Roshi asked Nishiara Bokusan Roshi, "The sounds of the bell, the raindrops on the roof, the water splashing along the gutter, where do they meet?" Nishiara Bokusan Roshi replied, "Bring me the mirror and I'll break it for you." Kiyoshizawa Ien Roshi asked, "What does that mean?" Nishiari Bokusan Roshi replied, "True eternity still flows." So, are there questions?
Listening and comprehending these poems and your description of them and how one can interpret them are very fascinating. But I also find myself thinking about it quite a bit, getting immersed and intellectualizing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I talked about it a long time. And I find that challenging because I could easily get swept up in the interpretation, if you will.
It's a great game. This is a great game. I think it's been a great game for centuries. Yeah. Yeah, the book that I've been studying goes line by line with this, and then gives something like 20 different translations, some of which are extremely different from each other, of almost each phrase. So a lot of people have had a ball trying to figure out exactly what this is trying to say. And in a sense, it doesn't matter, because it's about samadhi, it's about zazen. And it's just another way of talking about zazen, which is just one simple thing that we all know so well because we practice it. But that's fine. You could do your own translation. I mean, Ron's trying to do his own translation. So, you know, maybe we should all do a translation and see how it sounds. It would be remarkable.
But perhaps there's no translation required.
Yeah.
That's the challenge that I face.
It's hopeless.
Yeah. Shane, there was an interesting experience I had, which it was one of your talks. I think it was the last day, either Saturday night or Sunday. I don't remember exactly which, but the words were landing on me, and they were absorbed immediately, instantaneously, and yet I couldn't remember what the words were. It was a total consumption without interpretation, without really trying to understand.
That's the best.
So, yet I sit here tonight and I'm trying to understand, comprehend.
Well, we have both sides. So, Cornelia came to tea with me at my house yesterday, and we were talking about that, and she's opposed to really studying things because of just what you're saying, that they're so pure just the way they are, why try to interpret them? But from my side, I need both. I think most of us need both, because that's the way our minds work. You know, our big mind and our small mind both are at work. And if we can find words to express what we know, even though it can never reach it, it still gives us some kind of intention and direction that's very helpful. As long as we remember that it's not real and that it will never reach it. Yeah. Thank you. That's a very good question. Abijah?
I like what Ms. Argadatta Maharaj is a Indian teacher. Talks about that kind of where when he's telling someone about the teachings and they're asking him, you know, how am I supposed to interpret this? How am I supposed to understand this? It seems so far off, because he's talking about non-duality essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, treat it like food. You know what it is, and you think about it maybe prior to eating it, but once you put it in your mouth and swallow it,
it's gone. Gone. Yeah.
You don't think about how it's going, digesting in your body, and where it's at, and how it's doing. You know, how long is it going to take to come out? And, you know, it's like, in essence, it's a waste of time. And I know for myself that really spoke to me, because I would like hash this stuff out. Yeah. You know, where, man, I want to, either I wanted to hash it out and to understand it, or I would completely reject it.
Mm-hmm.
I would kind of have to see the futility in it or the waste of time in it. And I came to see that that was also my small mind rejecting it, rejecting wanting to talk about it, rejecting, you know, based on my small mind wanting to be my big mind, but having the impossible task of actually accomplishing that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I think it's really fun, too, as well, to have both sides. But,
yeah, it is fun. Thank you. Ron?
It's been a couple of weeks doing the same thing. I chanced to sit with a former sangha last week, and it so happened we went into some koan in Dogen's talk, you know, his book of 200-300, and I touched on this. Two guys talking, I forgot the name. And the first guy says, it is said that the ancient mirror was 10 meters. And the other master says, then how big is the fireplace over there? And the other guy says, it's as big as the ancient mirror. And the other one says, the tips of your toes are still not touching the ground.
Get real.
In other words, you try to put, so you analyze it,
yes,
you've lost it.
Yes.
Or you put a quantity on it.
Yeah.
Or whatever your interpretation of that koan, your understanding of
it. Yeah.
Or this.
Right, yeah. Donalyn.
One aspect of study that Aiken Roshi brought up about Birya, the Paramita, the energy, was this idea that, yes, we have a practice of Zazen and also study.
Yes.
And he also, you know, shared that there are certain times that when we study it, versus, like I remember starting this practice and I was taking notes and Angie quickly said, stop taking notes. And, you know, I'd want to read everything and eventually she challenged me not to read anything.
Yeah, I did.
A couple of years and said, stop that, just sit. So it's very, I mean, I realized that the study is so much about the interaction and the transmission with the teacher also. And how Aiken Roshi went on to say how it is our responsibility, it's part of the paramita, the area of the perseverance or energy paramita, for the student to take not control but to be proactive in our own education, not relying on the teacher, but relying on the sangha. I mean, even Buddha said, question everything that he said. So the studies, it's a very pertinent, interesting topic to see both sides of tasting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then getting how important it is that, as I learned to talk about the Dharma more,
that
it is a practice, and part of our study is part of that.
Mm-hmm. That's why we're supposed to, when we sit down to study something, chant what we just chanted before this Dharma talk. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. It's a way of saying, now we're doing something very particular, very, very special. There's the other side, when a guy who studied the Diamond Sutra forever and finally met a master who woke him up and he burned the whole thing up. So, oh, I've been going the wrong way all the time. He knew it by heart. He knew it backward and forward, but he didn't get it. So that's the other part of it, that we can lean on the words and the ideas and think that that's it. It's not. That's why we say no in the Heart Sutra. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. Those are Buddha's best teachings, his first teachings. But if we hold on to it, then it's no good anymore. You have to drop it all. Make room for the next. Well, it's after 8. Goodness, that went fast.